CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com, October the 19th. We've got stuff to do, people to see, places to go, and things to talk about. We've also got This Is Us coming up a little bit later on. Lebung's turn to do some travel. Bulela was in Cape Town last weekend. I was in KZN. The week before that, Bulela was in Knysna or in the Titicaca Forest somewhere. And I also made a quick whistle stop in Knysna. Now it's Lebung's turn. Apparently you're going to Cape Town this weekend.
Yes, exciting times. So my partner's been nominated for a couple of Lurys for some of the work that he's done because he's in advertising. So I was like, this is my opportunity to A, get the fuck out of this house, B, you know, get in a bikini and just like, you know, have my moment. So I'll just be like playing supportive girlfriend. But I haven't been to Cape Town in a while. The last time I was there, I was like hosting a conference in like 2018 and it sucked. Like the people were so mean and everything was so slow. So I was just like, ugh. So I'm hoping it'll be a better experience. I'm just like hoping it'll be more fun.
Cape Town's fun, man.
Depends where you stay.
Yeah, it depends who you know. It depends if your name is, you know, John, Michael, Michelle, Sarah, Sandra. Like,
where do you stay when you're in Cape Town? Where do you stay when you're in Cape Town? Cape Town has like maybe 1 kilometer of fun and the rest of it's actually pretty crap. You got to be on the Atlantic seaboard.
Okay, well, I literally just only go like right inside the city. I haven't explored it enough.
So that's
hopefully you can, that's you know, give me some pointers in Bulela. You're like the travel god here.
Atlantic seaboard. You want to get to Camps Bay if the sun's out. So if are you, when do you get back? Are you there on Sunday? I don't know.
I'm flying out on Saturday. I'll be back on Tuesday.
Oh, fantastic. So Sunday, so you do it Saturday, you're on the Atlantic seaboard, the sun's out, you're having a good time, blah, blah, blah. Sunday, you're in Camps Bay from around 1 o'clock till 6 o'clock. It bangs. That's the place to be. Beautiful people, awesome vibes. It's rocking and wide open. Wide open. So okay. Camps Bay, that's where you want to be.
Yeah, it sounded like you were whining a little bit.
Do not stay in the city.
It sounded like you were complaining a little bit there, like, meh, woe is me, Lebung. You're going to Cape Town and you're like, if only my name was Sarah, I'd be treated properly by people. Meh.
No, look, I must say that other times I've tried to go, you know, just even booking an Airbnb is just a nightmare. And not even just from my personal experience, a lot of people of color experience the same thing where just because, you know, that's not your name or whatever the case is, you get slapped. No hate on Cape Town. I mean, there are some very nice places and not all people in Cape Town are racist. But, hey, let's see when I get back on Tuesday.
No. There's not black people in Cape Town. Let's not apologize for that. The only black people in Cape Town I saw this weekend work at the shops. So please, let's not act softy around that subject. Oh, no, no. Oh, I didn't realize that's what you were saying. No. Don't expect to see black people. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's Cape Town. Let's not pussyfoot around that.
Yeah, I mean, Bulela can also help you out with like bad Airbnb decisions. So don't take his advice on that.
Oh my God,
he chooses Airbnbs like someone who chooses old socks instead of new ones with holes in them. And really good at that. The one guy you don't want to trust.
So well said.
The one guy you don't want to trust when it comes to Airbnb choices is Bulela. So, oh my God,
it's true.
No,
yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
Listen to this. Kala Fundavestazen says, guys, talking about travel, I just came back from a week in Nairobi and we've been caught with our pants down in South Africa. That is the new gateway to Africa. Only good things to say. We've been warned about
this. So interesting. We have. Interesting. So so my sister's moving to Kigali. So we'll see if we can get her on once she's there. She'll actually be around. I'll see if we can get her in studio and we can chat to her this week. About her, because she lives in the Ivory Coast at the moment.
Yes.
But she's just gotten an awesome new job. She's keeping her apartment up there, but she's going to move to Kigali for a year. So apparently that's also, so that's interesting to hear from Kala. That's Kenya, incredible place.
And Dogoza says, Cape Town is lovely. I love it here. And Chris T says exactly the opposite. Cape Town is cuck, don't come. So there we go, two different approaches. Corona's boring, says Lebung. Cape Town is clicky. It does not matter what you look like. They're snobbish.
Guys, you know what? if you're going to Cape Town, stop looking to be affirmed, right? They're richer than you. They're more beautiful than you. And it's not made for South Africans. It's made for tourists. Just go and enjoy. Go to the Atlantic seaboard. If you know what it's like, you know, people that travel and convert, you'll never enjoy it. Don't convert when you're in Cape Town. Go to the Atlantic seaboard, go to Camps Bay, and go and live your life, man. It's a special city. It's a very special city. You have the mountain behind you, the sea in front of you.
I've always maintained, I'm with you. You know what? I think Cape Town is a great mistress, a terrible wife. I don't go there because I want to be respected and loved. I don't go there to find my meaningful job occupation or to find some part of Cape Town that I feel that I most belong in or any of that shit. It's not like that. You go to Cape Town because your mistress, like that's your mistress. That you Cape Town is a place for holidays and for fun and for not taking yourself seriously. Everybody wants. You know, what do you, a city like, what city's going to embrace you with both Kabul and Afghanistan? Cape Town is.
Yeah.
Well, the Taliban are recruiting, so maybe.
Yeah, sure. That's a great idea.
I've got a few friends that actually like literally moved to Cape Town. They just left their lives in Joburg and went that side for work. And they came back such broken men. Oh, my word. It was just so sad. Like there was no growth. If anything, it was just depression and like more insecurity and just like more not knowing of yourself. So I agree with you guys completely with regards to like, you know, dip in and out of Cape Town.
Sure.
But don't like, you know, it's just not for all of us. You if you're a tourist, you'll love it.
I love the way that we've become so used to thinking of just changing your geographical location as making a change in your life. It isn't. Of course, it can be.
No.
But just making geography the priority is not going to solve your problems. I'm constantly beset by especially young South Africans, white, black, rich, poor, who say, oh, what's your plan? I say, what are you going to do with your life? Because ultimately, you have to come to that question, right? You're busy talking to someone and they're busy asking you about your career and kind of if you have any advice for them. And I say to them, what are you doing with your life? I'm going to. And I'm like, no, that's not what I asked. I don't care where you are in the world. The world is pretty much a global village now. It's not going to change anything to be in Copenhagen or to be in Sydney or to be in Afghanistan. Yep. What you have to do is decide what you want to do with your life. And the big problem I've always had with Cape Townians is they think that it is enough that they live in Cape Town. You say to them, what do you do? And they go, I've been in Cape Town. And you're like, no, it's not what I asked you. If geography is your answer, you haven't listened to my question. Sorry, that's not an answer to my question. What are you going to do with your life is different to where are you going to live? Not the same. And the same goes for all these people who describe themselves by saying things that I can see by looking at them. Well, I'm a Xhosa woman. Okay, all right. It doesn't help me to figure out who you are. You know what I mean? I that doesn't tell me anything about your personality. That is a boring piece of information. Or they say I'm a vegan lesbian, for example, like the last one I encountered in Cape Town. So much fun to know that about you. I could have told that by your straight cut fringe and the fact that you haven't smiled in 3/4 of an hour. I could have told that you were a vegan lesbian by then. I didn't need you to explain that to me. It is patently clear to anyone with eyes that you are a vegan lesbian. That is not interesting. Similarly, if you are a Khoisan man who is based in Upington, none of those things tell me a damn thing about you. Tell me you have a sense of humor. Tell me you're interested in building, I don't know, sustainable housing. Because at least that tells me something about you. These people who are looking for geography to solve their problems are never going to find happiness.
Gareth, how many people do you know that literally base themselves on the things that they have, the places that they live? They lack so much substance that's what they go to. So who are you? Oh, I'm this frat dude, you know, and that's all that they've got because they really have nothing else going on.
Again, it sounds unfair, but, you know, travel was never the priority for my generation, and millennials and Gen Z people seem to be completely obsessed with travel, like it's going to solve their problems. They're going to find some guru in a forest, or they're going to stumble upon a holy mountain, and it'll suddenly give them the meaning that they've been missing all their lives. Let me tell you something. Travel is a really nice part of life. There is nothing about it that is that is dreary and boring unless you're a dreary and boring person. But you can discover all kinds of interesting things. That should not be your purpose. If you list travel as one of the reasons that you live on Earth, like that's one of the things I think is most essential about me, then you don't really have a lot of depth and you're not going to find it traveling. I'm sorry.
Listen, Margie Thatcher and I disagree on a hell of a lot, but her words from earlier, if you didn't listen to the part one of the podcast, you should do that, is that, you know, what your character is actually the most important thing. And it started with this motivation culture that we have, right? And people always ask me, like, you know, just give me some inspiration, give me some motivation. I say, don't start with motivating people. It's a terrible idea. Because if a guy is an idiot, now you've got a motivated idiot if you motivate
him. And there's nothing more dangerous, right? Nothing more dangerous than a motivated criminal or idiot.
Yeah. So educate someone, like Thatcher was saying, is, you know, you don't want a motivated criminal or moron walking around. That's the last thing you need, is educate people what's important. And my old man used to say, be where your feet are. Be where your feet are.
If you can't make a difference where you are right now, what makes you think you're so special that you're going to suddenly make a difference in New York or London or Cape Town? If you can't make a difference where you are now, then rather, you know, start with the small things. Let's figure out how to make your own neighborhood a little bit better before you start telling me how you're going to reinvent Antarctica. I don't believe you. I just don't believe you. I don't think you're there.
No, you must change.
Well,
people always want the world to change. No, you must change. The world has been the same for relatively speaking since the agricultural revolution. You must change. People don't hate to hear that. You have to change.
I'm going to get so much shit from people over this whole conversation, Lebang. So I'm almost sorry you brought it up, because now we're going to have people saying, oh no, but actually where you live does make a difference. Some places have more opportunities. Of course they do. We know that. But if you think like some place is going to solve all your problems, I've got bad news for you. That's not how it works.
Speaking of places, I spent my afternoon in Alexandria yesterday. I go there like every month. I've got some mates. So I was chilling and there's this really, really, really wise guy. Like, I don't know where he's from. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how I know him, but every time I go and hang out with these people, he's always there and he just sounds like one of the most educated people, and he's not spewing shit out of his ass or anything, but he's got like real life practical things that he has to say about so many topics, like a range of topics. And I just sat there and I'm like, this is so sad. Like, this guy is literally probably one of the most interesting people that I get to meet often. And here he is stuck in Alex. And he's just like, you know, trying to make ends meet, just trying to, it just kind of made me a little bit sad. And they were like rallying, and I think the ANC or someone was around on their back heel, the Action SA, someone was going around talking to the people of Alex, and he was just like, look at this, look at this. They're going to sit here and talk to us and immediately after this, leave us, and we're going to now struggle, you know, to get something to eat tonight. Yeah. Blah, 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 blah. I just stood there and I was like, damn.
So what do you know about this dude? Because when I find wise people like that and they're out of their comfort zone, I mean, listen, there are wise people who've gone to different places. Again, this is why geography shouldn't matter, but it does. Just because they need to get away from bad influences, maybe, you know, drug addicts and that kind of thing. I mean, Space Brother Production says Port Elizabeth is great for solving a sobriety problem. But I think there are these people who you encounter in certain places who are really worthwhile getting to know. And this sounds like one of those people. But the politicians at the moment are on fire, man. They are doing their utmost. They've never worked so hard as they have in this month. And they'll continue to for a couple more days. And then it's over. You know, then it's done. Then we won't ever hear from them again. So tell me more about this guy. Why is he so wise? Why did you like what he had to say?
Well, number one, he's not in his home country. I don't think he's been there for a while, right? Yeah. And he tends to sort of look back on what it was like. Like, when I was back home, this is that. So, number one, the sad thing is I don't even know where this guy is from, but he's clearly living in South Africa because he has no choice. So when I say a range of topics, anything that I bring up, you know, this guy's like low-key Google dog. Like, he'll give you facts and give you like a lot of, maybe he just does a lot of research. The bigger thing was, how is this guy in the middle of Alex, probably not wearing any shoes, wearing the same clothes that he's been wearing for the past Lord knows how long, living in, you know, a 2x4 meter shack, how is he in Alex right now, in Alexandra? This guy should be a teacher, man. This guy should be, he should be something so much more. And I wondered in that moment about the immediate effect that a different environment would have had on him. I guess this is why I brought it up, because maybe, ultimately it's inside of you, right?
Maybe he's really clever and really interesting, but he's lazy as shit.
Yeah, it's possible.
You know,
it's possible.
That could be a possibility.
This is something we don't talk about because you can't teach people not to be lazy. So there's no course for it at school. So we just pretend it doesn't exist. You know, because if our education system can't solve something, we pretend it isn't there. Like, you know, if the hardware's broken,
I mean, you've just,
if the hardware's broken,
the laziness thing.
There's no amount of software you can upload to fix the hardware if the hardware's ruined. And in the case of laziness, like, I've often found in work, I would rather work with someone who's not that bright but works damn hard. They get things done. Than work with a clever... You know, you meet some genius sometimes, like someone really smart. They just blow you away. They know so much. They have an encyclopedic knowledge of everything, but they have no motivation. They wake up at, at like 10 in the morning. They don't brush their teeth. They eat junk food. They lie around. They smoke a lot of weed. They're very clever, but they're lazy as shit. That could be what you're dealing with here.
I think you're absolutely correct, because like life really be like that, especially in the townships. You wake up to just kind of drink and to smoke weed and to just hang out with your friends. There's not a lot of, you know, this get up and get you done. And it's just sad.
Don't we?
What
also,
I will do is I'll catch up with him.
Catch
up with him. I'll ask him.
Yeah, I mean, even try and get him on the show, because I'd be interested to know. And I'm not saying this guy is lazy, but you know, I'm sick also of hearing people make excuses for the virtuous poor. Like, you know, you live in a township, so life is just going to be horrible for you and all that kind of thing. I know some people. In fact, I used to do this thing with Bulelani Balabala in Tembisa, where we would go and speak to township entrepreneurs. These are people who also have nothing really in the morning to wake up for. No one's given them anything. They're struggling just like everyone else. They could be on Nyaupe or whatever else, but they decide to get out there and, you know, make homemade meals and sell them to other people in the township. Or they craft something out of wood. Or they sit there and they say on the side of the road, I'll do a paint job or I'll remarbleite your pool or whatever it is, and they get work. Those people are not sitting on their ass doing nothing and complaining. They're actually getting out there and doing things. Now, obviously, there are some excuses that we all can make. You can go out and cut thatch. You can cut grass in the fields and sell it in bundles of thatch if you really want to. You wash people's cars. You know, you can offer to cut the trees in someone's garden for them, because it's a hard, difficult job. But to sit there, it's like, you know, I'm also, we already got 17 million people in this country who are basically on welfare that the rest of us are supporting. So about 10 million people are supporting about 20 million people. I'm obviously rounding off, but that's not sustainable. Yeah. And why aren't those 20 million people finding a way to make themselves useful in the economy? You don't need to be a professor of, you know, nuclear physics to get a job in South Africa. We need people who can fix things, people who can clean things up. Look around us and see what a mess this country is, and see how we can start cleaning it up, fixing stuff, our rivers, our streets. I mean, we live in our own squalor, in our own filth in so many places, and people are prepared to do that. Well, no wonder we can't employ anybody, because they can't even find a use for themselves. I hate to be the hardcore guy who says these things, but honestly, I'm just sick to death of hearing everyone, especially politicians, making excuses for people. Politicians don't respect people enough to say, you could be better. They say, no, no, this is where you're at, and we'll help you maintain that low level. We'll keep you in filth. We'll keep you in your own squalor, because it means you'll vote for us again.
I mean, there's a lot of factors, you know, that come to play, of which we just generally don't have the time to get into. But I will work on maybe getting him to come through, because it would generally just be a breath of fresh air to chat to somebody that, you know, is knee deep in that life, but can still definitely hold a conversation for 2 hours like we can.
I'd love to.
Hey, you could just be a savant. I mean, the savants are everywhere on the streets as well. They can't make a real life work, but they can, they are genii.
Absolutely.
Like chess masters find these savants all the time, right? We've heard these stories, and they play against savants all the time just to keep sharp on their game. So the guy could just be a savant.
He might be. He might also be one of those people who's too clever to be able to use his brain in society. There are a few of those.
Yes.
Not a lot, but there are a few, because most really, really smart people find a way of applying themselves no matter how specialized they are. It's just, I mean, listen, I don't know this guy, and I'm certainly not referring to him when I refer to all this other stuff. But the fact that we think that we just write off a whole neighborhood of people because they don't have money, because they don't have jobs. There are some talented people in there, I guarantee it. You know, we can't write them
off. It's why these elections are crucial, both now and national, right? It's like, because actually for people, for us to find talent, it's all good and well to say most people aren't motivated, right? They're not self-motivated. They're just not. It's just not how the world works. Most people defer to comfort. You need systems. And what the politicians are not telling you is actually we don't want to do the hard work to create the systems. Because to find talent, actually the way to do it, let's stop mucking about, is you need 80% of the country to be somewhere on a database, and you need to keep track of them from around 6 years old to around 15 to 18, like the Germans and the Swiss do. In Switzerland, it is very unlikely to find a child that's getting straight A's in some village, and they don't know about her, and they're not identifying her.
Well,
you know what I mean?
This is precisely what this is what we're trying to do with This Is Us, which we'll start in a second or two. We've got Yatish joining us in a moment, and I believe you guys had an unbelievable conversation with Mike Abel last week.
What a firecracker that guy is.
Yeah.
Dude, no, he's great.
I just want to quickly go to Jared's comment here before we start This Is Us. Jared says, everyone needs a role model, someone you can look up to and who is an aspirational target. I was a lazy fuck until I met my previous manager. He pushed me to do my best. Now I am the manager.
I totally agree.
Love that.
Man, I love that.
Yeah.
Love that.
We all need that. We all need someone who takes us. You know, I saw somebody, probably the first person to really take me seriously. I saw her again at the Cape Town Marathon, and it was quite emotional to see her. It's been 2 years, and she's one of the first people to actually take me seriously in life. Mm-hmm. And she was a game changer for me. Yeah, absolute game changer.
Need game changers.
We do. Raylan says, I had 2 years with no work, doing and selling everything to make ends meet. It was hard, and because of pushing and believing, I'm now working and doing what I love to do. Yeah.
Congratulations.
I like that. I sold my business before COVID. Lucky me. Started learning how to make to trade Forex almost 2 years later. I'm still learning how to trade Forex. Ha, ha, ha. yeah. Robert is a doctor and says, the irony is that as a doctor, I see many able-bodied patients who are looking for grants, and the real deserving patients never do. You have to offer it to them. Yeah, it's amazing. There's a lot to talk about here. Okay, well, it's time for another edition of This Is Us. We are talking every Tuesday at 7:30 a.m. to Yatish Nasi and Lebang Hosana to unpack what we can all do in South Africa, and we can all do something to spread a little positivity, kindness, and good in the country. Inequality in South Africa, where climate change was when Al Gore was making movies. Sorry, let me read that again. Inequality is in South Africa, where climate change was when Al Gore was making movies. The data is mounting, but the awareness and urgency to act is just not there. How do we get more people to act? Well, today we're joined by Janisha Patel, who is Peace, Human and Security Development Researcher at the Institute of Justice and Reconciliation. And Janisha joins us today. Let's speak to her. Janisha, first of all, let me just introduce Yatish to those who have not had the pleasure of meeting Yatish on This Is Us before. I heard you had some really interesting conversations with Mike Abel last week, Yatish.
We did. How's it going, everybody? Good morning.
Very good. Yeah, I listened to the podcast afterwards, and he really is a hugely inspirational human being. And obviously someone in the same field as you are in, and someone who you guys were bouncing ideas off each other solidly there.
Yeah, you know, Mike's obviously sort of really, really old hand and seen it all before. So, you know, some of the things he'd spoken about as well, even after he and I connected and had a bit of a conversation. And that's why, you know, we're so excited to have Janisha on the show today, because, you know, some of the stuff he spoke about is how these movements very quickly become virtue signaling, right?
Yeah.
Sort of armchair activists, people stick a picture up or whatever, but don't actually do things and address the actual challenges. And, you know, we spoke so much about particularly how much of a challenge inequality is in South Africa. And if you look at the research and some of the stuff that Janisha and the team have been doing, and you see the sort of data coming out, and sure, the reports they put out are 80 pages long, but if you take the time and you go through it and look at some of those highlights, you know, it's a problem staring us in the face. We're arguably the most unequal country in the world. So if you think about stuff we need to do, those are the areas we're going to have to focus on and think about what we all do every day to try to address those challenges.
Well, let's do that. Let's get straight to it. Janisha, it's very nice to have you on the show. How are you?
Good morning. It's lovely to be here. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. How's everyone else doing?
Good. Nice to see you. Tell us about yourself and the work that you do at the IJR.
Yeah, that's probably a good place to start. So the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation was started in 2000, so a lot longer than I've been there. But it was sort of born out of the TRC to sort of almost continue the work that the TRC was doing in terms of nation building, reconciliation, unity, and those sorts of things. But has since grown so much more. The IJR now does peace building, you know, builds capacity in peace building infrastructures across the continent and sort of many post-conflict societies. And then what we also do is policy and research, and that's sort of where I come in. And so in our research and policy team, two things that we focus on are sort of public opinion data and then also the production of a knowledge base that is useful for Africans and civil society organizations, governments, international organizations, you know, a whole host of actors. So when we're talking about public opinion data, we collect these on two fronts. So we have, or we house rather, the Afrobarometer, which is a Pan-African public opinion survey that collects Africans' opinions on democracy, governance, the economy, all sorts of things. So it's just, you know, a handful of themes covered in the survey. And then we also have the South African Reconciliation Barometer, or the SARB for short, not to be confused with the South African Reserve Bank. But what the SARB does is really measures the national temperature on themes of reconciliation, unity, social cohesion, racial reconciliation, and so forth. And consistently what we find from the SARB every year is that South Africans say that the biggest thing that divides our nation is the gap between the rich and the poor, or inequality, really. And so that's where my project then comes in. I lead a project called Inclusive Economies that really researches the nexus between unequal economic growth and instability, or scarcity and instability, and sort of how can we get to peaceful, socially cohesive societies through sort of inclusive development and narrowing the gap between the rich and the poor.
Lebang and Yatish, you go ahead. I know you've got lots of questions on this front, and I'll bring up the rear in a minute.
Sure. I mean, I think that the place to start is arguably, you know, especially if you look at the incidents in July, right? I mean, all of us, you know, some people saw it and were surprised by it. I guess given the work you guys do, you probably saw this coming years in advance, right? Or had a sense that something like this was kind of brewing. You know, the more unequal we are, like you say, the more the chance of that instability sort of really rearing its head. Now, I've seen some say we're one of the most. I've seen others say we are the most. I mean, if we set the record straight, where are we globally in terms of inequality in South Africa? How bad is it for us versus everybody else in the world?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I mean, you know, there's so many ways to measure inequality, and I think that's probably where the confusion comes in. You know, you can sort of look at the Gini coefficient, and I don't want to get too technical, but, you know, for many years, we've used the Gini coefficient to measure inequality. And so that puts us in sort of the top five. But more recently, the World Inequality Lab released a fantastic data set that looks at sort of income inequality and also wealth inequality, so sort of how capital is distributed within a national economy. And when we look at those two indicators to measure inequality, then South Africa actually comes out right on the top in terms of sort of the distribution of specifically income inequality.
Yeah, I'm gonna have some very controversial things to say at the end of this. I'll just wait for Lebang to have her say.
And I really didn't say that you're gonna really enjoy this. So, Jay, yesterday I told myself, you know what, let me just try something different. And as I was driving, I bought a pack of bananas. And there was a guy in the back of a bucky. And, you know, he just was minding his business. And I opened the window and I said, hey, would you like a banana? And obviously he took it and he was like, thank you so much. And he then got scolded by the guy who was driving the bucky. Started shouting at him like, what are you doing? Can't just be taking things from people. Face the front and let's keep it moving. And I was just like, damn, this is so hectic. Oh, is there a possibility that this inequality is working for the people that have the power? Because I'm in a place where I'm trying to solve, I'm trying to get the solutions, I'm trying to close that gap. But why is there like this trend of keeping it in that way from your research perspective?
So I think what you're really pointing to is that, you know, South Africa is a society of haves and have nots. And, you know, these are sort of held in place by various structural barriers. You know, some of them, you know, sort of being our sort of inability to reconcile sort of injustices from the past. But, you know, if we talk about South Africa today, there is so much that divides us as a nation. And I'll maybe just give you some sort of findings from our reconciliation barometer, because that really gets to the heart of what makes people feel less unified or really what divides South Africans. And so when we talk about sort of interpersonal trust, and that's horizontal trust and that sort of trust between society, we see that South Africans really say that, you know, they trust their relatives and their neighbors the most. And then as we sort of move down the spectrum, we see that people say they sort of trust their colleagues. And on the lower end of the spectrum, where sort of interpersonal trust is the lowest, it's for foreign nationals, from people of a different sexual orientation and people from other race groups. And so, you know, there's almost this sort of barrier between people on these sort of demographic bases and sort of interpersonal bases. And perhaps it speaks to sort of a lack of compassion, a lack of, you know, really understanding each other's circumstances and maybe we've sort of lost sight of that. I don't know if that answers your question very well.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing for me that and you know there's two things that always throw me as well. So the one is you look at some of the sort of data and it shows that we've become more reliant post 90, like the more reliant on grants and more reliant on those sort of structures post 94. So, you know, two things, I think that could probably happen at, and it's probably where Gareth's going to probe soon, right? Is what you don't want, obviously, is for this to become an issue of just, you know, there should be more charity, more handouts, more, because it's not that, right? It's about giving people economic agency. It's about giving people the ability to find a way out versus just handing things out. I think that's really important. The other thing that's potentially really important, maybe we've lost sight of, and when you talk about horizontal trust, I really want to probe there because I think it was such a fascinating piece out of the research is, you know, so much of our conversation, our narrative is about South Africa. And it's often easy to forget that the country is composed of South Africans, right? And it's actually where the effort should be is between each other as opposed to just about the nation, right? It's about, you can't be patriotic for South Africa as a country and not offer the banana as Lebang did to a South African, you know, and that, you know, with This Is Us, I think those are the issues we're trying to think about is the relationship gap we have as a society between our country and the people that make up the country. you know, who we are versus what South Africa is. And I think those issues for me are probably where a lot of that nation building work needs to happen. It's not about politics, not about the national anthem, it's not about the rugby team. It's about how we behave amongst each other that ultimately plays a big role.
Yeah, I mean, you've said so many things there. I think, you know, nation building is a factor of symbols, so, you know, the national anthem and sort of, you know, the sports team and that sort of thing. But when we're talking about society as a whole, or before we get there, let's sort of talk about the relationship between our society and our government, you know, sort of the state-society relationship. And without getting too theoretical, in South Africa, it's not a very strong one. And, you know, there's various reasons for that, but we see that if we're talking about trust, and I know that's something that you're specifically interested in at This Is Us, and if we talk about vertical trust specifically, and so that's trust between society and the state, we see that South Africans don't have trust in state institutions. In 2021, we fielded our Afrobarometer survey between May and June, and we asked people how much sort of trust they have in various institutions, and sort of at the top of the list, where 2 in 3 South Africans said they have a lot or somewhat trust, sort of independent broadcasters sort of came out on the top of the list in terms of who South Africans trust the most. At the bottom of the list was, you know, local councillors, the police, the ruling party, their provincial premier, the parliament. And so you can sort of see that South Africans sort of, there's a huge disconnect between, sort of South Africans trusting their state. And then when we talk about horizontal trust, we see that South Africans trust slightly more traditional leaders, community leaders, courts of law. So, yeah, I mean, well, religious leaders as well. And so
I don't know. It surprises me that you guys are surprised by any of this, because it's patently obvious to me that we live in a society where all of these things are given. We don't need to be researching it. It's inequality is observable to even the least educated among us. I don't believe, though, that inequality deserves the amount of attention that it seems to get every day. Do you really think, any of you, that a poor person who's sitting unemployed in an awful part of South Africa, trying their best to just make it through the day, is that interested in the gap between them and someone very, very rich? I think they're just trying to survive, and it would be patronizing to almost insinuate anything else. I also think that These problems, while they are observable and measurable by Gini coefficient or any other means, it doesn't help to solve the problem. All we do is end up scolding the rich and virtue. We create this idea of the virtuous poor without being able to justify either, and we don't do anything to improve their lives. So we talk about it, and we talk and talk and talk, and all it does is it makes the people who are privileged in society feel better, because they feel like they're paying attention to the problem instead of actually solving it. I don't think inequality is an issue. I like inequality. I want to be as unequal to everyone else as possible as a person, and South Africa provides that in bucket loads. You can make a huge difference here, even if you have absolutely nothing. This country needs solutions.
Yeah, so where I'd push you, Garrett, is yes, inequality is observable, right? 100%.
And completely uninteresting, yeah, to even to the poor and the rich.
Correct. Potentially. But again, I'm gonna use the analogy, because often it helps, right? Using analogies helps you understand things, because you can compare it to something else. So the reason why we said, you know, you've got to compare inequality to sort of climate change is, I think many opinions were where you were 20 years ago, to say lots of data, why are we researching it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Tish, if I may, climate change, yes, and inequality are two unsolvable problems, which is why people in academia are obsessed with them, because they never have to actually find a solution to them. Climate change is not going to be fixed by any of us, not even Greta Thunberg, with all the love in the world, and neither is inequality. These are two things that have assaulted humanity since our dawn. There is no way we can control the weather. There is no way we can control volcanoes. There's no way we can control the level of the sea. And there's no way we can stop being unequal. There is no society in history where it's been equal for everyone. Not once. Not even in a small city state.
100%. But the issue, I think, that we really feel there is a chance and there is an opportunity, is when you talk about this idea of vertical versus horizontal trust, the least we can do, Garrett, the least we can do is at least behave in a way that is beneficial to how we behave, well, how we sort of have interpersonal trust with each other, right? As South Africans, at least the least we can do.
You heard what Janisha
just sort of put pressure put pressure on. Yeah,
Janisha just told you people have the least faith in the state. Yet we keep looking to the state to solve all of our problems. Again, I refer to the people of Harry Smith, who I regard as being silent heroes in South Africa. They went out, the people of the townships and the suburbs, the rich and the poor, supposedly. I mean, no one in Harry Smith is probably very rich by anyone else's estimation. But they all went out. They fixed the sewage plant themselves. They made sure that they retarred the road. They made sure that they made all kinds of changes to the highway that goes through them, which is their lifeblood. And that community, while they're not thriving, at least came together and worked. You mentioned the riots earlier as if that was an expression of rich versus poor. It wasn't. It was a political activity fomented by people who cynically thought that they could use the poor for their advantage and to their advantage. That wasn't about rich and poor. It wasn't a whole bunch of poor people who decided this is our time to steal from the macro because there's inequality. This was about politics. These people were politically motivated, and the people who tried to motivate them politically were trying to make a statement about their own importance. Tremendously rich people who spend most of the year in Dubai. This is not about poor South Africans taking matters into their own hands. No.
Gareth, you're completely right that when we're talking about what happened with the looting, that it sort of started as factional fighting within the ANC. Among, you know, extremely sort of well-off political elite. But what makes society vulnerable to instability is to have large segments of society who are consistently and perpetually materially deprived, because that allows for sort of political actors and populist narratives to take hold. And, you know, we see that across Africa. We see that where there's a large materially deprived population relative to sort of how wealthy the political and economic elite are, and that's sort of how we're talking about inequality, where we see that gap is really big, it leaves room for the elite, whether we're talking about political elite or economic elite, to sort of co-opt society and use the poor to sort of, you know, to meet their own ends in a way, for a lack of a better phrase, in this particular moment. And that's exactly what we saw in June. And so when we're talking about studying inequality, we're really looking at its impact on society and how it sort of it opens society up to greater instability, because pockets of people can sort of be used, taken advantage of, and are more prone to participating in violence, and specifically in political violence, because the opportunity cost for them to participate in violence is slightly lower. They're giving up a lot less. And so, you know, that's really what we're interested in, you know, trying to understand how inequality and material deprivation can open societies up to being vulnerable to more instability, to being co-opted by populist narratives, and those sorts of things. So you're absolutely right that it started
I concur with you completely on the fact that these things are exploited. But again, I say with tears in my eyes that us talking about inequality is not going to do anything. You think those poor people who are feeling disenfranchised and left behind and living in anarchy because their own municipalities are falling apart, you think those people are listening to us this morning go, yeah, that's what I need to hear? They're not. They're trying to survive today. That's what they're trying to do. Getting out there, selling whatever they can, making a deal, trying to help their kids get through school. They're also dealing with the pandemic and all of the consequences of that. And I'm just feeling like this inequality conversation is something rich people have.
I don't know, like Gareth, I mean, a lot has been said and a lot can be said. Two things. Like, there is a little bit of an obsession that people in low-income jobs, or people that maybe don't even have jobs, really do have with the rich. They are right next door. They are living in your backyard. They are looking at your mansion from their shack. There is this major obsession with, why can't I have that? What's so different about me that I can't have that? So I think when we bring forward this inequality conversation, it's in no way to make, you know, the rich people feel like, oh, they're doing something. And I disagree. I think that a lot of people in lower income places do want to hear this and do want to participate in these spaces that they previously aren't allowed in. And why Janish is here is to put emphasis on the solutions. Us, as this is us, we're saying, what is it that we can do? Not to make Karen feel better, not to make whoever in their high rise feel like, oh yeah, no, I am playing my part. Inequality is hectic. There's 9 bathrooms being shared by 3,000 people in a township, and you'll have no idea because you're so far removed. So the point is, hopefully this can spark something in you so you can feel like, shit, let me just get off my ass. Let's focus on solutions. What is it that we can do? That horizontal trust place, this is what we're here to discuss. And that's why Janish is here.
Yeah, and I think also just to, you know, to build on that, it's so important. Again, you mentioned things like what is this? There's nothing that can be done about climate change. There's nothing that can be done about inequality. I think what we're focused on is not solving inequality. That's not what this is about. What it's saying is what its impact, what it's starting to do is break down the trust between people in South Africa. And what that research is demonstrating is that a simple way to get back on the path to nation building is to start behaving between each other in a way that rebuilds trust horizontally. That's where the gap is. It's not about solving inequality. It's dealing with the impacts of it. That really is what we should be focusing on.
How do we – so when we say rebuilding horizontal trust, what are we talking about? Rebuilding trust in institutions? Rebuilding trust between each other?
So when we're talking about – yeah, when we're talking about vertical trust, we're talking about trust between the society and the state.
All right.
You know, that's a vertical relationship. That we're talking about horizontal trust. We're talking about trust among society.
And we all agree that vertical trust is not a problem that we're going to even attempt at solving because we've been misled by our politicians. All right. So horizontal trust, I think there is. And you brought up the riots and looting earlier. I saw a lot of communities coming together there. I saw people trusting their neighbors for the first time in ages. I saw people looking after each other, trying to help old people to find milk and bread. I saw people going in and trying to rally support for each other and for the things that counted in their neighborhoods. I think we have enormous amounts of horizontal trust in communities, as Janish has already told us. You know, people in churches, people in mosques, people, those are communities. Those people do trust each other, and they know they can rely on each other in a tough situation.
So, Gareth, what you're really speaking to is social solidarity, and a lot of research points to that social solidarity peaks sort of during and immediately after a crisis, and so it's almost like a curve, and then it starts to go down. And so I think what this is us is trying to do, and maybe, you know, you'll be able to say a bit more, but to keep that solidarity going. You know, we saw that when COVID just sort of hit our shores and we went into lockdowns, we tried to measure social solidarity in South Africa, and we saw that it peaked. And, you know, there was so much from, you know, sort of action networks and all sorts of things. And then again, after the looting, we saw that there was so much social solidarity. So how do we keep that going then after, you know, things died down? And this is us really helps to spark a debate about how to keep that going and, you know, how we can continue to mend that horizontal trust, because often after a crisis and things settle down, people retreat back to themselves and you know, don't have the capacity, whether it's sort of the material capacity, the emotional capacity, to continue supporting their community in such an onerous way. But you guys are absolutely right. We should be talking about solutions. We should be talking about what can we be doing and what can this as us be doing. And something that's come out of consultations that we've been doing at the IJR in communities with community leaders, and so this is a collection of qualitative, not quantitative data, is that, and you know, this happened from April to June, so it happened through the looting as well. We had sort of 3 months of consultations with leaders, and some of the things that came out, and I think, you know, this would be interesting for your tears and hopefully for your viewers as well, is that that people feel in communities that they don't have a space to come together. And I think, you know, this speaks to sort of building unity and solidarity among South Africans. And so, you know, it's a very simple and successful method that's been used all over the world in sort of conflict resolution and building trust. And it's just for communities to be able to convene and share spaces and for members of communities to be able to engage with each other. And this helps with what we call bridging and bonding. And so bridging is really bringing together people of sort of different groups who won't usually socialize, and bonding refers to bonding within groups where people would usually socialize. And so young people say that they don't really have places to convene, they don't have green spaces, and those sorts of things. And it's not for a lack of space, it's often for a lack of safe space as well. And, you know, this comes down to sort of addressing security concerns. We know we have this sort of trust in SAPs, and everyone's got an awful story about SAPs that you know, they've personally experienced. And so how can we keep these safe spaces safe? You know, are there options for community policing? And that's a question. I don't know the answer to it, because without a sense of safety, people will always have their guard up when interacting with strangers or people that they wouldn't usually interact, because they fear, you know, sort of both a loss of material things and also they fear injury, sexual abuse, loss of life and that sort of thing. And so if we're always wary of each other, we don't have safe spaces to come together. We're not going to trust each other. We're not going to break down those barriers. And then if we're talking about sort of economic solutions specifically at a grassroots level, you know, there's a lack of sort of spaces for people to convene who have similar economic activities, so spaces that facilitate cooperation rather than competition. You know, specifically referring to small businesses, informal businesses, and that sort of thing. And what we find in our reconciliation barometer, and Gareth, this is where the collecting the data is quite useful, is that we find that people identify four main barriers to attaining their goals. And those are sort of the obvious financial resources, but a less obvious one is access to the right people, access to the networks of right people. So people lack the social capital. And this is also where inequality comes in, because inequality sort of insulates networks of social capital among an elite, and sort of, and people at a community level don't have access to these networks. So how do we bring these networks to people? You know, studies of the labor market in South Africa show that one of the reasons that we have such a huge unemployment crisis is because there's a labor market mismatch. You know, employees can't get to the right employers for various reasons, you know, access to internet, access to economic hubs, like urban city centers and those sorts of things. So how do we bring these networks of sort of economic opportunity to people, so that it's not hugely expensive for them, but also just, you know, in instances where they can't access these networks of social capital because they're so, so insulated in South Africa because of inequality. So, you know, these are sorts of things that we should be looking at. We should be asking ourselves if we're talking about sort of community-centered solutions that focus on building trust and sort of bonding among society. I'll stop there for, you know, to hear what you guys think.
I think it's so cool that you brought up, you know, that from your research, it's showing that people are feeling like there's like a bit of a lack within that community and safety. And the two women that I interviewed a couple of weeks ago on my show with regards to This Is Us, these women basically have nothing, and they had to create that space for themselves. So in the same way that we're not waiting for the solutions to fall out the sky, in the same way that the government is not going to do anything for us, these women, with the little that they had, I think that the mother lost her job. She had been selling food all of her life, and then COVID happened. She couldn't sell food on the side of the road anymore, so she decided to make food for the hungry kids in the community off of nothing. So that sense of community was built by just her deciding that this is what I'm going to do now. So it just takes one person, is another thing that we need to realize. It's not going to be this huge show with the glitter and sparkles. It's just going to take one or two people to come together, and that sense of community will just sort of, it'll be so hard to escape it. One of the ladies was saying that, you know, people would drive past and just park their cars on the side of the road and say to them, what's going on here? We're just seeing a bunch of people. There's like an energy. What's happening? It just attracted more and more people. So that sense of community is something that, you know, you can't run away from it. Once it's there, it'll be very hard to miss. So it's just about one person just trying and building that horizontal trust.
Yeah, and the people on usually that you speak to, Lebang, on a Thursday, you know, for me, and it's to the point you made about solidarity at the moment is a reaction, right? It's often a reaction to a crisis. But the people you're talking to on Thursday are not reacting to crisis. They're reacting to the day-to-day reality, which what we're saying, Gareth, is in crisis. That's the difference, yeah. You know, and that's the thing to think about.
Yeah, I don't disagree with, I think, first of all, Janisha, you've been extremely valuable on the show this morning. And I find the kind of thing that you are talking about to be not only interesting, but useful in a practical sense to us, because we can implement the research that you do and try to find ways of doing things better. And, you know, if you aren't doing that, then really, what are you doing as a society? I just feel like a lot of the time I hear what is commonly referred to in academic circles as the white savior complex being behind all of this stuff. It's like a study of these statistics in order to create grievance culture. And I think in South Africa, we must be very careful not to go down that street because of the reasons you've already postulated, that the fact that we can't have, for example, the growth of an unfettered populism as a reciprocal action to people just complaining about how difficult and how dangerous and how unpleasant most people's lives are. The moment we do that, all we're doing is we're feeding into the nonsense that people who talk a lot and do nothing love to do. And we can't give those people any more quarter. They have led us in many ways down a path that has brought us nothing but suffering. And I'm concerned often when I hear about inequality that it's really just a ruse to try and make rich and powerful people feel better about the fact that they're exploiting. We know who the people are exploiting us in this country. It's politicians. It's people who in business are in graft and in crony capitalism. We know who these people are. And it's wrong for us to characterize our own society as being the problem when these people have made the society what it is. And we need to be very clear about that. Otherwise, we're not going to address the disease. We'll address a symptom of the disease. That, to me, is the major concern. So as much as all of this information is particularly useful and poignant in a place like South Africa, there are also other countries where inequality is a major thing, but they just don't care about it, and they keep moving. India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Jamaica, Venezuela.
I think, you know, you mentioned so many of these countries, but in a place like India, for example, inequality is actually improving. And, you know, you say
that's because of technology. Not because they've set up safe spaces in communities. Promise you that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's absolutely been a better dispersion of technology, access to internet, you know, and those sorts of things. And, you know, in South Africa, we need to be talking about those things as well. We need to be doing them rather.
Education.
You know, there's been a failure to sort of lay internet cables across the country in marginalized communities. And, but again, these are sort of things that the state ought to be doing. And here we're talking about what society can be doing. You know, a community can't go out and lay their own internet cables. They can't do it. But we also find in our research that South Africans don't have access to computers. They more likely access the internet from their cell phone. Mm-hmm. And a very small portion of people that we survey say that they have a computer in their household.
Don't need a computer. This does everything you need it to do anyway. I mean, mobile first is probably where we're ahead of the rest of the world. I don't think that's behind. Computer schmuter, you need this. And I think education is part of the problem that we have here because, again, we have been so reliant on the state. And this goes back to apartheid, obviously. You know, South Africans were used to black and white being told what to do by the government. And then suddenly we found ourselves responsible for ourselves and we decided, oh, hell, the only adults in the room are us. So let's get on with it. There are still people, though, who are hoping that some kind of Messiah is going to arrive and give them all the answers. It's not going to happen. It has to happen here.
Yeah, something I said to Yishish and Laban yesterday when I chatted with them is that we've become over-reliant on state-led development. But the survival of the state and the ANC party in South Africa is dependent on them telling society that they are the main supplier of development. And so people are continually sort of, they have these expectations and they're waiting for development to come from the state. And that is, of course, a part of the problem because we know the state can't sustain the promises that it's making. It can't sustain the level of development that it'd like to provide to society. And it can't be the main supplier of development, not in its current formation and with its current capacity. So I think this is us a spot on in that we look at sort of how society can be a supplier of development.
Well, that's why we're interested in doing this every Tuesday. And I thank you for your time. Where can we find out more about the work that you guys do at the IJR?
So you can visit our website. It's ijr.org.za. You can visit the Afrobarometer, which is theafrobarometer.org. And we're also on Twitter. I think it's @_IJR_, if I'm not mistaken. And we're also on Facebook. So we post our research on there too. But on our website, there's a full list of publications.
Very, very good. Any closing parting shots from you, Lebang and Yatish?
Yeah, sure. From my end, you know, since we started This Is Us and we really went on this journey, I think I've tried to take myself out of, you know, just looking and really trying to participate in making those little changes. And I promise you, it's infectious. It's contagious. If we just focus on what we can do, then we'll be fine. We're no longer in that place where it's blaming government, expecting government. Mm-hmm. They're not going to do shit. And it's not only for us to know, but even that information needs to be shared. Everybody needs to just get with the program. So coming up with just solves as a people, that horizontal, that this trust here as a nation, that's where we're trying to hone in. And every single Tuesday at 7:30, that's what we're going to do. Every single Thursday on Life with Lebang at 11 o'clock, that's what I'm going to do.
Beautiful. Yatish, you get the last word.
Yeah, perfect. You know, for me, I think, you know, the whole way along this kind of journey, I think what we've always tried to think about is, you know, even when we came up with the line, "This is us," part of it represented the fact when we say "this is us," we're saying this is all there is, that we cannot rely on, you know, like institutions. We cannot rely on government. What we have to rely on is each other as a society. This is all there is. Us is all we have. And what we do amongst each other and what we do for each other has a huge role to play in what we do as a country over and above what government will provide us, because we know that probably won't be much.
Very good. That's all we got time for this morning. I want to again just say a big thank you to Janisha Patel, who joined us this morning and brought us some pretty useful information and very interesting info too. And we will see you again same time next week for another episode of This Is Us. Don't miss Lebang's show on Thursday for more. She's always got really interesting guests on there too. And we will catch you tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. bright and early. Have an excellent day. Cheers, everybody.
Bye.
Cheers. CliffCentral.com